Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the July 23rd edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. So much has happened in the world since my last program, most of it bad, that it seems surprising only 2 weeks have passed. In Gaza, for the third time in 6 years, Israel once again has been quote-unquote, mowing the grass, and doing so with the backing of President Obama and both the Senate and the House, where resolutions endorsing Israel's right to quote-unquote self-defense passed without a dissenting vote. Mowing the grass is how Ephraim Inbar, head of the Begin Sadat Center, and other prominent Israelis have described the now ritual slaughter of hundreds of Palestinians consigned by Israel to live within the world's largest open-air prison, a 25-mile strip of land along the Mediterranean seashore housing 1.8 million people, most of whom are children under the age of 15. Other Israeli officials, among them ministers and members of the Knesset, are less sanguine in discussing their solution to the Palestinian problem. They openly call for mass murder. I'll get back to them and to Israel's war crimes in Gaza in a few moments. But first, until the abduction and murder of three Israeli teens near Hebron in early June, the biggest concern for Israel, or so the world was told, was the prospect of Iran developing nuclear weapons. Moreover, we were informed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that Israel had not ruled out the option of attacking Tehran's nuclear facilities should the negotiation between Iran and the P5 plus one countries fail to reach a conclusion or one to Tel Aviv's liking. Despite the lack of evidence that Tehran was engaged in the pursuit of nuclear weapons, sabotaging the talks between Iran and the P5 plus one countries designed to roll back Iran's nuclear enrichment program has been the major objective of Netanyahu, Washington's pro-Israel think tanks, and AIPAC, its chief lobbying organization. This past Sunday, July 20th, marked the formal end of the negotiations, but apparently and uniquely, both sides seem to believe they were going well enough to extend the deadline another 4 months. That's the one piece of good news I have to report. The stakes for Iran in this are very high. Its economy has been saddled for years with punitive sanctions, largely driven by AIPAC and the same neocons who brought us the Iraq War. By extending the negotiations, Tehran expects some incremental relief from those sanctions and further access to funds that have been frozen by American banks on the orders of Washington. At 20 minutes past the hour, I'm going to be speaking once again with historian and Iran expert Gareth Porter. We'll be examining what the negotiations have accomplished up to this point and the likelihood that both sides will reach an agreement by November and what might occur if they don't. In view of the controversy swirling around the downing last week of a Malaysian airliner with 290 persons aboard over eastern Ukraine, it's well to recall a similar incident that took place on July 3, 1988. That's when Iran Air Flight 655, a civilian passenger flight from Tehran to Dubai, was shot down in mid-morning by a missile fired by the U.S. Navy cruiser USS Vincennes while it was in Iranian territorial waters. The plane was cleared in Iranian airspace over Iran's territorial waters in the Persian Gulf and on its usual flight path. All 290 persons on board died, among them 66 children and 16 crew members. By coincidence, it was the same number that perished in the attack on the Malaysian Flight 17. Neither President George Herbert Walker Bush or his successor Bill Clinton would ever apologize to Iran, but in 1996 the two countries agreed to a final settlement at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. While recognizing the incident as a terrible human tragedy and expressing deep regret over the loss of lives, the Clinton administration would not admit legal liability. It did agree, however, to pay $61.8 million, amounting to a little over $213,000 per Iranian passenger, in compensation to the families of the Iranian victims, and another $70 million to the families of the remaining passengers. In 1990, President Bush awarded the commander of the Vincennes, William Rogers III, the Legion of Merit for, quote, for exceptionally meritorious conduct in the performance of outstanding service as commanding officer from April 1987 to May 1989, end quote. Whether President Obama has thought about the attack on the Iranian plane, the account of which is not disputed, it wasn't evident in his remarks at the White House Monday morning. The president accused the government of Russian President Vladimir Putin of arming and training the pro-Russian separatists who he claimed were responsible for downing Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, and that Putin needed to force the rebels to provide access to the crash site in eastern Ukraine. Obama also said that investigators had been barred from entering the widely spread out crash site by separatists who fired warning shots into the air. Whether the president was consciously lying to the American people, he's been known to do that before, or was simply not informed, I can't say. But while I was listening to his comments on NPR, I was watching inspectors from the Organization for Security Cooperation of Europe, the OSCE, on the ground at the crash site, being interviewed by the media on RT, that's Russia Today, the foreign language TV station that's accessible on the internet and on certain cable channels. I also watched and heard on RT Malaysian officials questioned why Ukrainian flight controllers had ordered the plane's pilots to alter the flight's course and had instructed them to fly at 33,000 feet instead of the usual 35,000 feet. While the administration claims to have information that incriminates the rebels in the downing of the plane, Russian officials have already presented evidence that they believe points a finger at the new post-coup Ukrainian military, which employs the same Russian missile system which reportedly was used in the deadly attack. As of late yesterday afternoon, U.S. intelligence officials can only agree that the plane had been brought down by a Russian missile. What they are still trying to determine, according to ABC, is whether the trigger puller was a Russian, a separatist trained by Russia, or possibly a volunteer familiar with the missile system from the Ukrainian military and who may have joined the separatists. The separatists located the plane's two black boxes and turned them over to Malaysian authorities. If nothing else, their contents may explain why the Ukrainian air controllers sent the plane on its deadly course. Now let's return to the war on Gaza. What should be clear is that all the events up to now were planned and choreographed by Netanyahu, with one exception. Neither he nor the Israeli military were apparently expecting the level of resistance it has experienced from Hamas. Observers are comparing the situation to Lebanon in 2006, when Israel's vaunted elite brigades were humiliated by Hezbollah, and in Gaza it seemed to be happening again. But for how it began and why there are now over 600 Palestinians dead, as compared to about 30 Israelis, three-quarters of them women and children, that's the Palestinians, some blown up in their homes, others gunned down in the streets by Israeli snipers, let's go back to the apparent kidnapping of the three Israeli teens. It was clear to Israeli officials from the call to the police by one of them that they had been abducted, followed by shouts and shots that the three were dead. Yet for 18 days, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, the Netanyahu regime maintained the fiction that they were still alive, that they had been kidnapped by Hamas, yet it provided not a single scrap of evidence for that charge, and it has not done so since. Why? Israel obviously was already planning the assault on Gaza, but Netanyahu needed an excuse, and an Israeli Jewish population ready to support him to the bloody hilt as it had in 2008 and again in 2012. So during those 18 days, Israeli soldiers arrested hundreds of Palestinians who were believed to have links with Hamas, including 51 who had been freed as part of the deal that freed Israeli corporal Gilad Shalit, who had been captured on the Gaza border in 2006. Understandably, this provoked Hamas and had let fly hundreds of mostly harmless rockets further into Israel than ever before, most of which were shot down by the U.S. taxpayer-financed Iron Dome missile defense system, and while causing Israelis to take cover in air raid shelters, kill no one. By the way, the U.S. Congress has now appropriated $621 million since for that missile defense system. Anyway, Netanyahu quickly used this to justify the launching of U.S.-paid-for F-16s and Apache helicopters, which soon began taking a toll of Palestinian lives, while attacking hospitals, destroying apartment buildings, while humanely, we are told, first informing the residents to get out or be killed. Four boys gunned down from the air while playing soccer on the beach received no such warning. But in crowded Gaza, there was nowhere to go. Soon, as the Palestinian death toll was mounting, there was a predictable worldwide call for a ceasefire, and Netanyahu had obviously taken that into account. Working apparently with his old friend, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and Egypt's new Israeli-friendly dictator General al-Sisi, the Israelis fashion a document which would have left Hamas and the Palestinians locked under siege in Gaza with exactly the same situation they were in before. In fact, not only had the conspirators not bothered to bring Hamas into the so-called talks, its officials had to learn about the ceasefire proposal from media whose pro-Israel spin Netanyahu assumed correctly it could count on. Hence what you saw in the headlines and heard on the tube and on the radio was that Israel had accepted the ceasefire and Hamas had turned it down, as Tony Blinken from the State Department said on NPR this morning. The onus for continuing the war and on the Israeli invasion of Gaza was to be on Hamas. That Hamas had come up with a 10-point ceasefire plan that would have normalized life in Gaza while ending attacks on Israel was ignored. Netanyahu and Israeli spokespersons were ready with a new reason to continue attacking Gaza, to destroy a number of tunnels that Hamas had built deep underground along the Israel-Gaza border, which presumably would allow its fighters to sneak into Israel and commit attacks on Israeli civilians. The problem with this story is that it is not new. It is, in fact, relatively old. As far back as 2005, it turns out, the Israeli military was well aware of these tunnels and curiously did nothing about them. Over the years, there have been articles in the Israeli press about them, similar to the ones that they built under the Gaza-Egyptian border, and yet no evidence has been presented that they enabled terrorist attacks or significant infiltration by members of Hamas into Israel. No matter. In Israel, as I mentioned earlier, public figures have openly called for the mass shedding of Palestinian blood. We'll start with Gilad Sharon, son of the late Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, who gained his reputation for butchery in subduing resistance in Gaza following the 1967 Six-Day War. Sharon writes, quote, in the Jerusalem Post, "The desire to prevent harm to innocent civilians in Gaza will ultimately lead to harming the truly innocent, the residents of southern Israel. The residents of Gaza are not innocent. They elected Hamas. The Gazans aren't hostages. They chose this freely and must live with the consequences," end quote. And later he goes on to say, "We need to flatten entire neighborhoods in Gaza. Flatten all of Gaza. The Americans didn't stop with Hiroshima. The Japanese weren't surrendering fast enough, so they hit Nagasaki too," end quote. Then we have Moshe Feiglin, head of the Knesset's Jewish leadership faction. He has a 7-step program to eliminate any resistance to Israel in Gaza. It begins with an ultimatum. Quote, "One warning from the Prime Minister of Israel to the enemy population," he writes, "in which he announces that Israel is about to attack military targets in their area and urges those who are not involved and do not wish to be harmed to leave immediately. Sinai is not far from Gaza and they can leave. This will be the limit of Israel's humanitarian efforts. Hamas may unconditionally surrender and prevent the attack," end quote. The fact of the matter is, while Sinai is not far away, Egypt keeps the entrances to Sinai tightly sealed, and Feiglin knows that. Next, Feiglin lists attack. Attack the entire target bank throughout Gaza with the IDF's maximum force, and not a tiny fraction of it, he writes, with all the conventional means at its disposal. All the military infrastructural targets will be attacked with no consideration for human shields or environmental damage. It is enough that we are hitting exact targets and that we gave them advance warning," end quote. On the day before, 15-year-old Mohammed al-Qadir, the young Palestinian boy, was kidnapped and burned to death by 3 ultra-Orthodox Jews in Jerusalem. Knesset member Eilat Shaked of the ultra-right-wing Jewish Home Party wrote on her Facebook page, quote, "Behind every terrorist stands dozens of men and women without whom he could not engage in terrorism. They are all enemy combatants, and their blood shall be on all their heads. Now, this also includes the mothers of the martyrs who send them to hell with flowers and kisses. They should follow their sons. Nothing would be more just. They should go, and should the physical homes in which they raise the snakes. Otherwise, more little snakes will be raised there," end quote. A few other comments which you won't read or hear in the mainstream media. This from Israel Katz, a member of the Minister of Transportation. "Gaza," he said, "should be," quote, "bombed so hard the population has to flee into Egypt," end quote. Reverse Exodus. So, Gaza should be wiped clean with bombs, says Avi Dichter, the Minister of Home Front Defense. And finally, there is Israeli Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, who wrote that Israeli soldiers must, quote, learn from the Syrians how to slaughter the enemy, end quote. Meanwhile, comfortably seated on camp chairs and sofas, the press has reported that Israelis gather to eat popcorn, drink beer, tend their barbecue, and watch from a sought hilltop as bombs rain down from U.S.-supplied F-16s on Gaza. Just as they did in 2008 during Operation Cast Lead, they clap and applaud each deadly blast from 1,000-pound iron fragmentation bombs. Speaking Monday before Christians United for Israel, with Sheldon Adelson and Senator Lindsey Graham in attendance, Israel's ambassador to the U.S., an American-born turncoat named Ron Dermer, took umbrage at criticism of the Israeli army's actions in Gaza. Some are shamelessly accusing Israel of genocide and would put us on the dock for war crimes, Dermer said. But the truth is that the Israeli Defense Forces should be given the Nobel Peace Prize, a Nobel Peace Prize for fighting with unimaginable restraint, end quote. Dermer's comments followed a statement issued by Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, who on Sunday said that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, is the, quote, most humane and bravest army in the world, end quote. Martin Buber already saw the handwriting on the wall when he told a Jewish audience in New York back in 1958, quote, when we followers of the prophetic Judaism return to Palestine, the majority of Jewish people prefer to learn from Hitler rather than from us, end quote. You wouldn't know it from reading the newspapers or listening to your radio, but Israel's depredations have not gone unnoticed in the world. In Paris, Berlin, Brussels, London, Mumbai, Dublin, Auckland, many other cities, and last Sunday in San Francisco, tens of thousands of people who had seen the images of murdered Palestinian children and the wanton Israeli violence on their TV or computer screens poured into the streets in support of Palestine and to protest Israeli war crimes. Yet except for Paris, where a government prohibition of anti-Israel protests led to a confrontation with police, not a word, not a picture seemed to have made it through the pro-Israel screeners of the U.S. media.